Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work.
Yeah, we did. We had to work to pay the cost. That's the wonderful Dara Williams. You'll soon join me in Columbus, Ohio to give a wonderful concert. Dara Williams is fabulous. She was joined there by David Burns of the great Pete Seeger singing the Solartopia song on the great Grammy-winning album, Tomorrow's Children. We're going to talk today about nuclear power, actually, with the great nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen. We're scheduled to be joined first by Dennis Kucinich. Dennis, are you with us yet? Okay, so Arne, we're going to talk with you about global warming and nuclear power. Are you with us from Vermont? Arne Gundersen, are you on with us? Okay.
Hello?
Hello, Arne?
Yeah, hey, this is Arne. I'm going to try the main line, which is a better line, and you're calling me on my cell line.
Okay. Why don't you call in from your better line, Arne, at 888-874-4888.
Okay, good. I'll do that.
4888, okay? And if you'll let me know when Dennis joins us, that'd be great. Dennis Kucinich has been a congressman from Ohio. A multi-term congressman from Ohio. He is one of the country's great activists working for peace and social justice in the world, and has advocated for many years a Department of Peace to replace our Department of so-called Defense, which is really a Department of War. We're going to be talking about the upcoming election as Trump Day, the day of reckoning, rapidly approaches here, and threats of, I'm not sure if they're threats of violence yet, but they seem awfully to portend of violence of people turning up at the polls to so-called monitor people of color from election at the election, something that the Ku Klux Klan did for many, many years. Do we have Dennis with us now? Okay, we got both. We're going to start with Dennis Kucinich today. Arne Gundersen will join us in about 15 minutes to talk about global warming and nuclear power. Dennis Kucinich is going to be with us in 15 minutes. I know you've got a tight schedule, as does Arne, but Arne has agreed to talk with us at the end of the hour about from 15 minutes on about global warming and nukes. Dennis Kucinich, you're in Washington. Can you give us an idea of what you're doing now, Dennis, and what your fears are that we discussed before the show about the upcoming election?
Well, I'm in Washington. I do most of my work here for the Fox Network. I provide political analysis and commentary and provide what, you know, is often the other side of the political equation. And so, you know, I've had an opportunity to speak to an audience that is surprisingly receptive to some of the things that I've had to say about the political conditions in this country. As far as the election, I don't come from a place of fear, but I do have concerns. I have concerns about the red baiting that's going on from the Democratic Party, riling up the base against Russia, about the statements of Secretary Clinton with respect to a no-fly zone in Syria, which would put us on the verge of war with Russia, about the money that the Clinton Foundation took from Saudi Arabia, which is promoting the ouster of Assad and a caliphate in Iraq and Syria. America's going the wrong way in the world. And I have been a powerful critic of our country's international position and policies for decades. And that hasn't changed, whether it's a Democrat in the White House or a Republican.
And what was your position, Dennis, so people can be more familiar? I am, of course. You and I worked together here in Ohio when you were in the state Senate to defeat a proposed nuclear waste dump. It was a major victory, which could not have happened without your staunch support from your position in the Ohio Senate. And then you went on to become elected a U.S. congressman from Northern Ohio. Prior to that, you had two terms as the mayor of Cleveland. How many years were you in the House of Representatives?
I served 8 terms, 16 years, and in 2004 and 2008, I was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president, running on a platform, not just to end war, but to take America towards a green economy. I proposed in 2003 a Green New Deal that would be the basis for taking us away from nuclear and fossil fuels and moving us in the direction of clean energy, as well as today I'm working with my wife on regenerative organic agricultural policies, which would create in farms across the country an enhanced carbon sink that would sequester more of the carbon through getting out of chemical agriculture. So, you know, I remain involved in these things. It's remarkable how global climate change has been given short shrift in this election. It's very sad that the critical issues that are confronting the American people and the world are being hijacked by debates about personalities and the peccadilloes of one of the candidates. So I think that the American people have been done a disservice by this political process this year, and by both political parties, frankly.
What's your position on global warming and how we can solve it, and the role of nuclear power, which has been on its way out clearly, but how do you think we can solve the global warming crisis?
Well, so first of all, let's talk about nuclear power. I opposed the Davis-Besse and the Perry nuclear power plants when they were being built on Lake Erie years ago. The industry touted itself as creating power too cheap to meter. It was too expensive to use. The nuclear industry is responsible for driving industry out of Northern Ohio because of the high cost of electricity to pay for plants that were neither used nor useful. The big lie that was told by the nuclear industry is what they didn't tell is a liable mission. They didn't tell the people that the cost of storage is going to be offloaded onto the taxpayers forever, which is one of the reasons why you and I worked together in 1995 to block a nuclear waste dump in Ohio with waste from Iowa, Indiana, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Missouri. And in my research on that, Harvey, and you and I talked about this 20 years ago, the fact of the matter is that you cannot isolate nuclear waste from the biosphere. When you put it in these casks, eventually they erode from the bombardment of the of the material inside the cask, and they leach into water, or the water comes up to the cask because they try to store them or bury them. There is no way to protect the atmosphere or the biosphere from radiation that comes out of these plants. This is a nightmare, and it's a triple canopy nightmare because it's a financial nightmare, it is a environmental nightmare, and it's an energy policy nightmare that keeps repeating itself. One of my last acts in Congress was to try to block a $60 billion bailout of the nuclear industry, which has thrived with the help of the Department of Defense. And it's a key part of this crazy nuclear weapons program that we have. So, Harvey, that's so much for nuclear. Now, with respect to global warming, we have to recognize that it exists. We have an obligation to lower our atmospheric carbon levels. I was one of the leaders in Congress in an effort to do so, but we could not get the kind of help that we needed. The world is still stuck trying to suck every last ounce of energy out of oil and coal, and we are seeing atmospheric levels of CO2 increase. That's one of the reasons why I'm, you know, working with my wife, who sees agriculture using farms as a carbon sink as a way to start to sequester gigatons of CO2 in the soil. And you know, we've gone the wrong way on all of our policies, because they're being driven by an energy industry which is responsive to Wall Street and their investors, and not responsive to the health needs and the environmental of the American people and the environmental needs of our nation and the world.
Well, how exactly would you use farms to pull carbon out of the atmosphere?
Well, you know, you get away from chemical agriculture, and you get away from, you know, because what happens with the soil, they ruin the soil. If you go and drive through Ohio, or you drive across Iowa or Indiana or any of the other farm regions of the country, you're going to see, you know, a lot of GMO crops that have been planted, Roundup Ready used to cause the plants to fight off weeds, but they're destroying the biology of the soil, and the soil's getting stripped. It doesn't have proper nutrients. And so what happens is there's carbon that gets released from that, and what we need to do is to repair the soil so that the soil again becomes a carbon sink. And the only way to do that is through using organic agriculture, getting away from the use of chemicals, so the soil gets a chance to recover and to have the proper nutrients, which then put the soil where it's in a position of being able to absorb the carbon from the atmosphere. You know, we're doing it all wrong. We let our earth become barren, and we are releasing more carbon into the atmosphere. Our chemical agriculture has created a plethora of health problems for the American people. Roundup Ready with its glyphosate is an environmental nightmare that the American people are only becoming dimly aware of. And we need to not just challenge those health concerns, we need to rescue our agriculture from the monopolies, from the chemical companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and go back to that old-time religion of helping people get back into farming and return to a sustainable agricultural practice, which is heavy on organic agriculture. It doesn't rely on chemicals and relies on people reconstructing their relationship with the land and with nature.
Sounds like a great plan. And do you have an organization that's working on this that people can plug into?
Well, Elizabeth is on the board of the Rodale Institute, which is the oldest organic organization in the United States. And she is also the Washington representative of the Plant-Based Food Association. And there's a new organization that asked them to that asked Elizabeth to represent them in Washington. It's National Organic Farmers, started by the executive director of Rodale. We both have worked with the Center for Food Safety and with Food Democracy Now. You know, there's a national movement out there to have food that's fit to eat and water that's safe to drink and air that's that we can breathe without damaging our health. And it's really about reclaiming the natural world and our place in it, so that we're not just widgets or integers in a society which throws people away like cogs in a big machine, but that we celebrate our humanity through enriching it with policies that are sensitive to our health, to our moral and intellectual development. And certainly a change in agricultural policy is called for. I mean, Wendell Berry was writing about this generations ago. You know, there are other great scholars who understood the nature of agriculture and its relationship to the world. Charles Walters comes to mind. You know, we really have an opportunity here to return to the kind of agriculture that America was built on. And just, you know, the, you know, mechanization might have a role, but chemical-based agriculture has been the dish that ran away with the spoon. We have lost sight of and believe that somehow economies of scale, just like nuclear power. Remember, they sold it on economies of scale, and that's what industrial agriculture has been sold on, economies of scale. We're going to feed the world. Well, frankly, the problems of malnutrition in the world, I have a hell of a lot more to do with the lack of distribution of food than they have to do with the lack of availability or access to food. The food is not properly distributed. We need to change the distribution channels, and we need to make stop subsidizing big ag, help farmers get parity. I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be done to repair our relationship with the land.
Well, Dennis, what website can people go to? I've lived on an organic hippie farm for 14 years. It was an eye-opener to me, having grown up in suburban Columbus, Ohio, to find myself on a farm in Massachusetts. And everything you said just now totally resonates us. We were actually visited by Rob Rodale, and that's R-O-D-A-L-E for folks listening in, who called us the new peasantry. And then, of course, things came together when they tried to build a nuclear plant 4 miles from our house. We, as you have so eloquently put it so often, didn't think that a nuclear power plant was going to be compatible with organic farming. But tell us where people can go on the web to...
Well, yeah, they can, you know, they can. There's different places. You go to Kucinich.com, ElizabethKucinich.com. Go to Elizabeth's Facebook page, which is replete with a lot of information about the work that she does. I have a Facebook page where it's pretty heavy on international policy, but it's worth looking at. And again, if people want to reach me, they can do it through Kucinich.com. Just send me a note, and I monitor it and try to get back to people and contact me. But, you know, beyond that, Harvey, I think, you know, we're going to need to reconstitute a real peace movement in America. And basically send a warning to everybody who's holding any office that if they think they can manage the affairs of a nation by taking us into another war, they've got another thing coming. We've had 15 years of continuous war in the Middle East, and you know, at a cost of over $6 trillion. We have to be done with that, or war is going to be done, you know, it's going to do us in. And so I'm talking about a new policy that changes our relationship with the world, with each other, and that's part of an unfolding approach towards integrating humanistic policies and instincts in our relationship with all people and with nature and the world.
Well, Dennis Kucinich, you are a brilliant guy, and it's been a pleasure to know you all these years. And I'm shocked that this is the first time I've had you on the show. So I'm going to have you back. You said you got to go, so I've got Arne Gundersen waiting. So I'm going to have you back to talk strictly next time about
peace. Harvey, let's talk again soon. And you know, back at you. You're having a chance to work with you when I was in the Ohio Senate was a very important development in my career. And to learn of your commitment to truth and honesty and energy policies and how you just have never relented in your commitment. So I want to thank you, Harvey. And look, let's talk again soon. I'll look forward to it.
All right, Dennis. Thank you. You know, some of us just don't know how to stop. And thank God that you're still on the case. And we'll talk to you again soon.
I will. Thanks, Harvey. And I'll make sure... we get you in touch with Elizabeth, too, because she's terrific.
Yes, absolutely. I have met her, and she's wonderful. So we'll talk to you soon, Dennis Kucinich. Thanks so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. And we will look for you on Fox News. Okay? So take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. 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 Okay, that was Dennis Kucinich, folks, here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, former congressman, 16 years in the Congress from Northern Ohio. We can talk later about how he got pushed out. But we are joined now by a fellow, a wonderful
guest who's been on the show before, but who has issued a really very important new report, and we're going to devote the rest of the show to him and his report on global warming. I want to point out that Arnie does not take any political positions, does not back any candidate. Dennis didn't either, actually, in his talk, but Arnie's talk is separate and has its own things to deal with on global warming and nuclear power. So, Arnie Gundersen, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, Harvey. How are you?
I'm great, Arnie. How are you? Good to talk to you again. You get the rest of the hour. We want to talk about this amazingly important new report. I got to say, I was roundly amused. I mean, I can't help but laugh when I see these guys. There's a merry band of pro-nuclear people running around calling themselves environmentalists, hugely funded by the multi-billionaire Rachel Pritzker, and with all this money coming in from our drug companies to support the nuclear power industry. They have likened themselves to Gandhi and King and God knows who else in support of the most the deadliest technology I think ever invented, commercial atomic power. And they're making this claim that somehow nuclear power, which does emit carbon, is helping us with global warming, which is, well, I'll let you speak to it. Arnie Gundersen, you are a nuclear engineer. You're based in Vermont. You did, as far as I'm concerned, the most important work on Fukushima. When the Fukushima accident happened, you were the only person out there with major expertise that I could find who was telling us the truth about what was happening at Fukushima continually and relentlessly. I mean, your Fairwinds organization was the one lifeline to any understanding of what was happening at Fukushima. Your work was just absolutely unique and invaluable. And now you followed up with another report, which is a big deal, posted at your website. I think it is either posted now or about to be posted, the truth out. Tell us what this report is and what you mean to say.
Yeah, well, thank you, Harvey. I have to go back to talk about the AstroTurf groups that are claiming to be environmentalists. You know, AstroTurf means they're fake green organizations. You know, you listen to these people and they say, well, one time I was against nuclear and now I'm for it. They've never written anything in the past that said they were against it. You know, it's a ploy. You know, I've gone the other way. I was licensed reactor operator in the nuclear degrees and ultimately a senior vice president in the industry. And now I think it was a colossal mistake to build the ones we have. And we're just doubling down on a bad mistake by even considering nukes in the future. So I'm one of those that went the other way that the press doesn't seem to want to quote. You know, they always quote these quote environmentalists who've now seen the light and have accepted that nuclear power is the end all, and in fact it is not. And there are many of us who've gone the other way, but the press doesn't want to
look. Well, let me point out, I want to interrupt you just one second, Arnie, because I was thinking about this today, and I have to say that in many ways the key people in the movement against nuclear power are people like you, who had tremendous expertise and who came out of the industry the other way. And the two people that really jump to mind are John Goffman and Ernest Sternglass. John Goffman was a co-discoverer of plutonium and uranium isotopes. He was part of the Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb. Without his discoveries, in some cases, nuclear power might not be possible. He was the chief health officer of the Atomic Energy Commission. And while he was in that position, Ernest Sternglass, who was also in the nuclear industry, came out with a report warning the nuclear power plants were killing people. And the Atomic Energy Commission dispatched Goffman to refute his findings. And Goffman wound up confirming his findings. And these two guys who came out of the industry, Goffman and Sternglass, really laid the foundations for the health criticisms of atomic power. And now you have come out of the engineering side. There were three engineers from General Electric who also had a similar position. And you, with your tremendous expertise, are debunking pretty much everything the industry supporters have to say. So you now have more to say. Let's hear it.
I'll add a couple more to that, too. You know, you've got Peter Bradford, former NRC commissioner. You've got Vic Stella, who was Victor Galinsky, rather, who was a former NRC commissioner. You've got Greg Yasko, who's chairman of the NRC. I mean, these guys are heavy hitters, and also feel that the pressure on the of the nuclear industry on Congress is forcing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to look the other way on safety issues. You know, and I listened to Dennis's comments earlier too, and he struck upon Department of Energy. I mean, my God, that's nothing but a nuclear cheering gallery there. So let me tell you about what we did. Now, thank you for that. It's important to look back. You know, when I was I started the nuclear industry in '71, and there were about 250 nuclear plants proposed up until the mid '70s. Only 120 got built, and of those, about 22 or 23 are broken, so we're left with 99. But none of them came in on schedule, and none of them met whatever price goals they were scheduled for. You know, frequently they thought they'd be in at $400 million, and they came in at $8 billion. You know, so we're not even talking close. So the concept of too cheap to meter was blown out of the water by 1975. So the other thing that the nukes were supposed to mitigate, and this is why I got in it. You know, I was essentially a religious zealot, and nuclear power was going to provide ample energy to everybody. And I can remember gas lines in '73, and oh my God, we needed to build those nukes as fast as possible. And there was no energy shortage, and certainly when you start trying to replace energy with more expensive alternatives, like nuclear, it was absurd. So these nuclear plants were built on the promise that they'd be cheap, and that on the promise that they would eliminate the energy shortage. But none of that happened. So that was last century. You know, when I was in the industry until 1990. I was absolutely committed to nuclear because it was, I thought, going to save the world from an energy shortage. Well, it never happened. Now, the nuclear industry's changed its tune, and they're saying, oh, you need these nukes for carbon dioxide mitigation. Carbon dioxide's a greenhouse gas that makes global climate change or global warming. So, but when they were built, nobody even thought about carbon dioxide. So they needed a new marketing ploy. That's really what this is all about. So these the nukes that are there, the 99 we have in the country and the 438 that are around the world, never made sense economically. So they needed a new marketing ploy. So nuclear is now hiding behind, and I call it the CO2 smokescreen. They're hiding behind carbon dioxide. Oh, you need it because all the polar bears are going to die unless you build a nuclear power plant. So that sort of sets the stage for where we are right now. I'm going to go back to you for a second, and if you need me to fill in any gaps before rambling on, I will.
Marty?
Yes.
You keep talking because you're making perfect sense. And, it's a great story you're telling here. So
okay.
Continue. Tell us about the report. I'm happy to let you talk. I've seen you speak. You're a wonderful speaker, and I don't need to interrupt you. Just go ahead and tell your story here because no one else – folks, I want you to know that Arne Gundersen is a tremendously qualified – uniquely qualified nuclear engineer, and for a nuclear engineer to come out of the nuclear industry And to say the kinds of things he's saying takes tremendous courage. I mean, Arnie had a very powerful career with a very substantial income, I'm sure, that has gone by the boards now. And I will say one thing for the proponents of nuclear power. I was in a debate, well, one proponent, I was debating Stuart Brand, who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, about the nuclear power. And there was someone else pro-nuclear on the line, and they accused us in the anti-nuclear movement of making money fighting nuclear power. And Stuart Brand said, well, I disagree with these people, but nobody ever got rich fighting nuclear power. And I'm sure, Arnie Gundersen, that you are living proof of that.
No, you're right, Harry. You're absolutely right. I love it. So, well, at least Brandon and I agree on that. It's funny, I was out in, I was giving a speech at California Polytechnic, Cal Poly, back in November. And there was a troll there from Diablo Canyon. And after my half an hour speech, he said, you know, you're really slick. I could almost agree with everything you said. But, and then he said, tell me something. How much do you make? And I said, I do this for free. I'm living on my Social Security. And his jaw almost dropped. So that was the high point of my speech that night.
But there you go.
Let me get on with the CO2 story then. I'm going to get a little geeky here and throw two concepts out. One is a gigaton, and that's how they measure the amount of carbon dioxide that we throw out in the air, and that's 1,000 million tons. Some people would call it 1 billion tons, but the British and the Japanese don't use that term. So in the scientific community, it's called a gigaton, a billion tons of carbon dioxide. Big number. And the other number is ppm, parts per million. And that's the concentration. When you throw all this carbon dioxide into the air, it gets diluted by air molecules. So the concentration of the carbon dioxide in the air is measured in ppm, parts per million. Parts, atoms of molecules of carbon dioxide divided by 1 million molecules of air. So that's what ppm is. So now it turns out that some really smart guy in Hawaii back in the 60s started measuring carbon dioxide levels. And he was at a facility called Mauna Loa. And the Mauna Loa data is the gold standard of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's been continuous since 1960. So they've got 50 plus years of carbon dioxide data coming out of Mauna Loa in Hawaii. And when they started, the carbon concentration in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, was about 320 parts per million. And throughout recorded history, when you go back before the Industrial Revolution, you know, say about 1600, carbon dioxide was 280 parts per million. So over 200 years, it went from 280 to 320. So Mauna Loa picks up in 1960 at 320. By 1988, it hit 350. And that number should ring a bell with some people in your audience, because there's 350.org. And 350.org is saying we've got to get back to 350 parts per million if we want to save the Earth. Well, now it's at 400 parts per million and growing every year. This is the first year where it stayed above 400 parts per million for the entire year. So think about that. From prehistory until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it was going along at 280. And that's just normal background carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Then it went up to 320 in 1960s. And now it's up at over 400 in less than 50 years. So it's going up at about 2 parts per million every year. Now, where is it coming from? In 1970, that's the earliest data I can find, mankind was throwing up into the air about 16 gigatons of carbon dioxide every year. And that's the steel mills, that's the cars and the trucks and the boats and the planes. Whenever they burn coal or when they burn oil, they put up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so they were putting up about 16 gigatons of carbon every year into the Earth's atmosphere. So now we're at 36 gigatons. So it's more than doubled in 50 years. Where does that come from? Everybody wants to live like America. You know, everybody wants a car or a truck or a house with central heating. And it's not going to stop. The other thing we found is that even with it, you know, remember this Paris Peace Accord, the COP21 that happened a year ago where all the nations pledged to cut back on their carbon dioxide?
Well, right.
Yeah, that was a big deal. But still, even if the developed countries like America and Europe cut back, there's still an awful lot of countries that want to live like us. So MIT is estimating that even in the best circumstance, there's still going to be about 60 gigatons in the atmosphere in the next 30 years or so. So even with the COP21 accords, carbon dioxide is going up. Even in the best circumstances, it's almost going to double because everybody wants to live like us. You know, you can't very well turn to someone in India and say, you know, you have to stay where you are, but America can live a different lifestyle than you. Now, what that means is we've got to turn it around. And what Dennis was talking about how we can capture it with plants. That's one way of doing it. But the nuclear industry is saying, well, we should build nuclear power plants to reduce the amount of carbon we're throwing up into the air. And they're proposing 1,000 nuclear power plants between now and 2050. That's one every 12 days for 35 years. Now, think about that. A nuclear plant every 12 days for 35 years. That's the nuclear energy position. Some people are actually saying 2,000 or 3,000, but let's go with the nuclear position. So they're at 1,000 nuclear plants. And the question is, how much would that cost? And if you go to investment bankers, you know, let's take you and I out of the equation, and let's take the pro-nukes out of the equation. Investment bankers say that's going to cost about $8 trillion. That's with a T. I didn't say with a B. I said with a T, $8 trillion to build those 1,000 nuclear power plants. And the problem is that those nuclear plants are only going to save about 3 gigatons of carbon dioxide. Remember, we're at 60. So they're going to save about 3. They're only going to make a 5% dent. We're going to spend 8. If you listen to the nuclear energy industry and if you listen to the Department of Energy, they would have us spend about $8 trillion to make a 5% dent in the problem. That, to me, that just doesn't make sense.
Well, especially since they can't get the plants built on time anyway. I mean, it takes, what, 5-15 years to build nuclear power plants, and they don't work and they don't come online. Small details like that. But go ahead, Arnie, please.
Yeah, and that gets to the geeky word here is opportunity cost. And economists use that all the time. Where could that money be spent if it weren't spent on nuclear power plants? Well, carbon dioxide is not going to take a vacation for 35 years while those nuclear plants are going to be built. And in fact, when you turn them on, you'll never, ever get to the point of being able to draw out the carbon dioxide they built up while they were being built. So these long construction periods and these huge costs are never considered when you hear people go to Congress and ask for money for the next nuclear boondoggle. So what we did was we looked at alternatives, and the cost of renewables now is about 1/5 of what nuclear is. So, you know, that's why are we even considering a nuclear future if
the alternatives right now, and the prices are going down, are about one fifth of what they of what a nuke would be. And of course, I'm just talking money here today. I'm not talking about the devastation of Native American lands for the mining. I'm not talking the devastation of Fukushima Prefecture in the event of a disaster, or the long-term storage of waste for a quarter of a million years. No, this is just about the money. The money doesn't make sense. And I think that Wall Street understands that. And Wall Street's been certainly not very fond of ponying up $8 trillion, given the track record of nuclear power over the years. So what we found is that... Yeah, go ahead.
Your report then talks about the carbon impact of new nuclear plants.
Yes. You know, the new nuclear plants... By 2050, they would reduce the total carbon dioxide thrown up in the air by 3 gigatons out of 60 gigatons. It's peanuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not going to help.
When you look at the alternatives, our position is you get 5 times more bang for your buck money-wise. And you can build a solar or a wind farm in about one-fifth the time. You can build it in about 3 years compared to 10, sometimes 2 years compared to 10. So it's 5 times cheaper and it's 5 times faster. You can actually begin to bend the curve if you invest that $8 trillion in renewables. And you're never going to bend the curve if you invest it in nuclear.
What do you mean by bending the curve? Explain that term a little further.
Ah, okay. Well, carbon dioxide's going up. You know, every year, it was at 350 in the 80s, and now it's at 400, and it's going up at about 2 per year. So by 2050, it's likely to be, it's 35 years, 70 ppm higher than it is now, or 470 parts per million. At that point, you start to get to the point where the Earth is warming way too fast, and you can never recover from that kind of global warming effect. So investing $8 trillion for an outcome that takes 35 years to get to and only makes a 5% bend in that 2 ppm per year growth rate is absurd. You can fire up renewables faster and cheaper and turn, instead of going up at 2 ppm, you can change it to 1 ppm and then 0 ppm and flatten it out. And then things like what Dennis Kucinich was talking about, there are techniques to take the carbon back out of the atmosphere and get back down to where the Earth can live pretty comfortably, you know, in that 350 part per million range that 350.org feels is necessary to have a sustainable climate that doesn't have superstorms and doesn't have droughts and doesn't have ocean flooding. We can get back to harmony with nature. And it's interesting because that's what Dennis was talking about, too. We can get back to harmony with nature with a renewable strategy, and we'll never get there with a nuclear strategy. They take too long, and they cost too much.
Well, so, this is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and the Solartopian vision is a vision of an Earth totally powered by renewable energy. Arne Gundersen, as a nuclear engineer, is that possible?
Yes, yes. You know, and I'm not the only one saying that. There have been some brilliant minds well before mine, and Amory Lovins comes to mind. You know, Amory's been preaching this since 1970. You can have a renewable economy where, for instance, Texas right now, there's so much wind power in Texas that electricity is free from 9 o'clock at night until 6 in the morning. Now think about that. You can cool down ice in the middle of the night and use it as air conditioning when the power comes back on. You can store that electricity thermally, you know, it can make ice or whatever. And in the process, that's a power plant that doesn't have to run. So we're already seeing the future. You know, I think 100 years from now, you and I will be long gone, but 100 years from now, people are going to look back on this argument as you're not being pro-nuke or anti-nuke. It's really about a different vision. It's really about a distributed generation system. Lots and lots of little generators, as opposed to the 20th century concept of central station power, a big power plant every 50 miles or something like that. That's what the battle is about right now. Are the people going to get back to power plants essentially on their roofs or in their backyards or on their farms? Or are we going to go with industrialized power and the huge finance costs and the huge profits associated with running them? So I think we're on the as we come into the 15 years into the 21st century, but the last century, we had to build central station power. We didn't have computers. We didn't have reasonably priced solar, et cetera. But now we don't. And the old guard, the people that are making huge sums of profits on central station power, don't want to let go. So I think it behooves us, you know, you and me and the thousands of other people who see this vision, to push for a distributed economy. The example's a tree. What does a tree have? Does a tree have a couple really big leaves, or does it have a thousand little leaves? I think Mother Nature teaches us that a distributed system is a lot more natural than a bulk system with central station power. So that's where the world is going in this century, away from the old paradigm of central station power toward a new paradigm of distributed generation.
Absolutely. And of course, there's an interesting dynamic, Arnie Gundersen, you may have heard about. In the state of Nevada, people, including some friends of mine, were encouraged and the economics worked out and it all looked good, and they put solar panels on their rooftop. And they put so many solar panels that they, in Nevada, individually owned or leased, that they drove the utility to the brink of bankruptcy. And the utility now has fought back with the help of the legislature, which is owned by the Koch brothers, have made it now so that people who put solar panels on their house are not only not benefiting from them, but are being forced to pay more. So the utility is doing everything it possibly can to drive out solar on rooftops, but they're simultaneously wanting to build a large central solar power station and sell solar energy to all the other people. And so it's beyond, actually, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it's beyond the debate over nuclear versus renewables. You have a utility company that wants to build renewables, but they want to own it, and they don't want people to at the grassroots to own it themselves.
Yeah, and it's not just Arizona. There's Florida, the Sunshine State, actually has a ballot initiative in November on solar power, and it's really cleverly worded. And the Koch brothers and Florida Power and Light and others are behind it. It's designed to make you think that a yes vote is good for the solar industry. In fact, a yes vote will shut solar power down in Florida. And it's actually a no vote that will get will allow solar to thrive in the Sunshine State. We're seeing that almost everywhere, not in Vermont, where I'm talking to you from, but where the utilities are under enormous pressure by well-funded lobbyists who work for the big electric companies. They're under enormous pressure. But you know, it's a false argument, Harvey. They'd say, well, if you put a solar collector on your roof and we buy the power, let's say they're buying the power at 7 cents or something like that from you. They're going to say, well, but what about the distribution and the transmission and things like that? You're not paying for that. So we need to bill you for that. That's their position. But really what they're forgetting to talk about is that solar makes the most sense in the middle of the day, because that's when it's hottest and that's when the sun is out. And in the middle of the day, utilities are buying power at about 20 cents. So the people with solar on their roofs are actually subsidizing the utility by selling it at 6 cents. So it's that's when the load is highest. So what's happening is solar is trimming the peak load. In the 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock at night is when the air conditioning loads are the greatest, or the heating loads up here in the north. And that's when solar is the most effective. So it's knocking down the peaks, which is where the utilities made all their money. So I think you're right, though. It really boils down to who's going to make the money. Are we going to keep the money in the citizens' pockets, or are we going to shovel it up to the large corporations? And I hope that through different legislative initiatives, that people can control the 21st century power generation paradigm and not the large corporations.
Well, now, Arnie Gundersen, Arnie, tell us your website, fairwinds.org, is that right?
Yeah, it's Fairwinds with an E, F-A-I-R-E-W-I-N-D-S. It was started by my wife, Maggie, and both she and I were in the nuclear industry. She was in nuclear public relations, and I was the lead nuclear engineer on a project when we met and fell in love. So we both crossed over and feel strongly that a renewable future is not just achievable, but makes economic sense, too. So the site is fairwinds.org, and I gave a speech at McGill University up in Canada, and the most recent posting on the site is the McGill speech. And then I also put all this into a brief 1,800-word letter to the people that read our site, and you're welcome to download it and spread the word. Basically, CO2 is a smokescreen for the nuclear industry. They failed at saying it was cheap, and they failed at saying it was going to solve the energy crisis. And now, to justify the next $8 billion they want to take out of our hide, they're saying they need it for carbon dioxide reduction, when in fact it will make carbon dioxide reduction worse. Carbon dioxide will go up when we start building these nukes, not down.
Well, I am skeptical that they'll ever get a chance to build these new nukes. And what I'm most concerned about now, and where the battle has come with these pro-nuclear people, is the 99 reactors that are left, which are all falling apart. And we have a fleet of nuclear jalopies, which, the wheels are falling off and the carburetor is blowing up. And this is very, very dangerous. Now, in Vermont, you succeeded in shutting Vermont Yankee, but we had 4 reactors in upstate New York on the brink of shutting down, and now the governor has come in and wants to give them $7.5 billion, and they're in Ohio trying to subsidize Davis Bessie. I mean, if ever there was a reactor that was about to blow, it's Davis Bessie, and then you got Diablo Canyon, 2 reactors surrounded by earthquake faults. What is this going on here, and how dangerous, Arnie Gundersen, is it really to keep these old reactors operating?
Yeah, you're right on the mark there, Harvey. By the way, there's a great movie that will be coming out on HBO sometime in the beginning of 2017, and it's called Power Struggle. It's about the experience here in Vermont of how the people took control of their own destiny and shut down Vermont Yankee. But what's happening around the country now is that Governor Cuomo has waffled and is trying to subsidize 4 upstate nukes with downstate money. He's basically taking $8 billion out of southern New York's economy and shoveling it up into northern New York's economy to subsidize nuclear plants that no longer make economic sense. Basically, he's subsidizing a buggy whip manufacturer. All the car has replaced all of the horse-drawn carriages, and he wants to keep buying horse-drawn carriages and buggy whips. That paradigm, unfortunately, is being latched onto by other states. And it looks like a massive transfer of wealth. There, you know, that $8 billion may save some jobs in upstate New York, but it's going to lose jobs in downstate New York. I mean, there's productive new jobs that would be created by those that $8 billion that's getting transferred up to an aging nuclear plant. And you're right about the aging issues on these plants. You know, it's we all know when a car gets to 40 years old, you wind up having enormous costs to maintain it. And that's there's a recent study out that says that just the maintenance costs on a nuclear plant are above what renewables would cost. So just keeping these things maintained, forget the fuel and forget the people and things like that, just maintaining them is more expensive than wind. There's a great report out about Diablo that says the same thing. Keeping Diablo running an extra 20 years, that money could be more efficiently used by building renewables. So it's crystal clear that you've got an entrenched interest in impoverished towns. You know, there's a lot of environmental justice issues here. You know, these nukes were not built in Fairfield County, Connecticut, or Orange County, California. You know, they were built in poor areas. And so when the single biggest source of income dries up, a lot of people are begin to complain to their congressmen. So there's a lot of political leverage in these impoverished areas to keep those plants running. But what it does is it transfers money from productive jobs to non-productive jobs. And unfortunately, so far at least, it looks like New York State might pull it off.
Well, of course, there's a lot of lawsuits, a lot of resistance to this. I think the statistic, and we're nearing the end here with Arne Gundersen, fairwinds.org, fairewinds.org is Arne's website. He and Maggie Gundersen have been doing incredibly great work on this. The statistic that jumps out at me is that according to the solar energy industry, there are more than 200,000 people in the United States. So more than 200,000 people working in the solar industry in this country and less than 100,000 in the nuclear industry. And there's about 90,000 in wind power and less than 60,000 in coal. So I think the transition is underway. Arne Gundersen, you are a spectacular national treasure. So great to have you. What's your final word here as we fade off into Solartopia?
Well, thank you, Hal Harvey, and thank you for seeing this vision well before the rest of the world. You know, there's we owe you and Dennis and a lot of other people an awful debt of gratitude for beating the drum when no one was listening. And I'm glad to follow in your footsteps.
Well, and I'm following yours. Let's get these old reactors shut before the next one goes up, for God's sakes. And keep up your great work, Arne Gundersen, you and Maggie at fairwinds.org. Thank you, crew in New York, for another great show. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Listen to us on PRN, and we'll be back again next week. Take care.
Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on a garden.